May it please the Court, Justice Berger, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs, Martin Lessner on behalf of appellees and plaintiffs below. If I may introduce William Wachtel, who will make the argument on behalf. Also at council table is Kristen DePalma and Meekan Zakataki.
And welcome to the Court. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Michael Weidinger on behalf of Albert Nasser and Kids International, defendants and third-party plaintiffs below. Nasser and Kids respectfully request that this Court reverse the Court of Chancery's decision below that enforced an unsigned settlement agreement or remand for further proceedings, and we do so on two grounds. First, the agreement is unenforceable because it is an integrated agreement that purported to settle a pending case in New York courts, but there was not an executed agreement as required under New York law. Second, substantial record evidence demonstrates the agreement furthered tax evasion by Gila Dweck, and in such circumstances, it would be against public policy of this state to enforce it.
And before you move to your next point, the way you framed the first two issues, it would lead me to conclude the fact that there was an agreement is not going to be an issue in this appeal. The question is whether it's enforceable. Is that correct?
The question is whether it's enforceable or not. We did not challenge the court below's findings that under Delaware law, the application of Delaware law, that there was an enforceable agreement by the parties. What we have challenged is that is unenforceable as a matter of law based on New York.
I understand. So we're not talking about implied consent, apparent authority, actual authority, anything like that. We're done with that. We've now got an agreement, and the question is it enforceable?
That's correct, Your Honor. We did not appeal those ancillary issues. I've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. New York Civil Procedure Law, Section 2104, requires any settlement agreement other than one made between counsel and open court. It's not binding unless it's signed by the party sought to be charged or his attorney. Whether the parties entered into an enforceable contract given the undisputed legal requirement is the proposition for this court to consider, I believe, de novo. My opponents suggest that it should be done under an abuse of discretion standard, but those cases are an apposite because they talk about the enforceability based on the fairness of a settlement. We're talking about whether or not this is enforceable as a matter of law, and it should be reviewed de novo. Now, Section 2104 of the New York law admits of no applicable exception.
Right. Before you jump to New York law, and the reason I asked about the enforceability of the agreement is the agreement had a choice of law provision for Delaware law, and how is that going to relate to what you're going to now tell us about New York law?
Under our rules, whether or not the court should enforce an agreement that contains a choice of law provision does not just look to the parties and the parties' expectations. There are other principles and other interests at stake, particularly state law. We've referred the court both Delaware state law and New York state law on these issues. We've referred the court to various provisions cited with approval by Delaware courts of the conflict of law principles. A choice of law provision in a contract is not necessarily enforceable for all issues, and the court should look to those conflict of law principles to decide what law should be applicable with respect to dismissal of that New York action. The comments to Section 199 of the restatement says where that the conflict rules apply, where there's a dispute between what the formal requirements of the two contending states are as to whether or not it should be enforceable. In other words, you don't just look to the contract provision and what seems to suggest is okay by agreement of the parties, i.e. Delaware. You have to look to those conflict principles. And Section 187.2b says, application of the law of the chosen state would be contrary to a fundamental policy of a state that has a materially greater interest in the issue than the chosen state to be decided, then that materially important issue should be decided by that other state's law. That's fundamentally what we're saying here. As a matter of comedy, this court should look to New York law to decide the question of enforceability, given the fact that there's a plain and unambiguous statement by the New York legislature, supported by New York's highest court, that there's a non-waivable writing requirement to settle an action pending in New York courts.
Mr. Weininger, just a mechanical question about the way the settlement would operate. As I understand it, once the court approved the settlement agreement, well, determined what the settlement agreement was and then approved it, is it correct that the only action that would be required in connection with the New York lawsuit would be a dismissal, the filing of dismissal papers?
The only action that remained in New York, and that's set forth, I think, Your Honor, in the judgment that the court entered below, was that my client was required to execute a stipulation of dismissal, which is now being held in escrow, and which, pending the outcome of this case, if the court upholds the court below, would be the last and, I believe, only act that's necessary in New York.
Had the stipulation not been put into escrow, but filed with the New York court, then would that have ended the New York litigation?
Well, it would have. It would be subject to the challenge that we're making here today as a matter of, I think, res judicata, that dismissal, which was part of a settlement of a New York action.
Now, I'm just asking mechanically, if that piece of paper had been filed in New York, would that conclude the New York litigation?
Once that stipulation of dismissal is on file in the New York court, I believe that would conclude that litigation, Your Honor.
Right. No action by a judge of that court would be required in that circumstance.
I think it would be a matter for the clerks to simply accept the papers and the filing. I don't believe that there's any decision that would need to be made at that point, subject to some other collateral challenge by the New York courts. I think it's for that reason that we're asking this court, out of comedy, to respect the New York State Court's requirements with respect to a settlement of a New York pending action. We're suggesting
let's test that. If the parties had agreed voluntarily to stipulate to a dismissal of the New York action, then we would achieve the same result that would have obtained here but for the escrowing of the stipulation of settlement. Isn't that correct?
If the parties had agreed to settle their litigation by stipulation of dismissal, Your Honor, I think that under the law of New York, that would have to be in a writing. That writing might well be just the stipulation of dismissal executed by the parties who agreed to that execution. But as a practical matter, we have argued that we are being forced to sign a stipulation of dismissal by an order of this court, which is contrary to the public policy of the state of New York, because the state of New York would not require us to do that because there's no signed writing evidencing our assent to the settlement agreement that's causing that to happen.
Well, if the parties hypothetically had agreed to settle the case or dispose of the New York case by simply signing a stipulation of dismissal, then that stipulation of dismissal would be the writing required by New York law.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. That the part, as long as it sets forth the terms, and there's a requirement under 2104 that the terms. The answer is yes, subject to that being the terms of the transaction. Section 2104 requires that the defendant file the terms of the stipulation.
They don't have to file their settlement agreement, do they?
I believe 2104, the terms of that settlement agreement have to be on file. And it's fairly I think it's commonplace that the parties will enter into agreements and stipulate to the dismissal, and that's effective to end a New York action. But that's not what happened here.
So every time parties to a lawsuit in New York want to dispose of the litigation, want to have it dismissed, and they do it as part of a more comprehensive settlement, which in many cases might include material that nobody wants to have on the public record, that settlement agreement has to be on file as a public document?
It's my understanding that the parties can ask for confidentiality of those terms, but that the statute, I think, just a straight reading of the statute is fairly clear that the terms need to be filed by the defendant.
Well, let me follow up on Justice Jacobs' question on mechanics. You said there's something in escrow that's going to be filed with New York depending on the outcome of this case. Does that include the unsigned agreement that the chancellor is, vice chancellor is enforcing here, or is it simply a stipulation of dismissal?
It's simply a stipulation of dismissal, as I understand it, that right. is in
And as I understood your other answer to Justice Jacobs' question, if this case is affirmed, someone would take it up to New York, file it, end of the New York case. But why I'm confused is you seem to be suggesting that when they take it up to the clerk's going to say, where's the agreement? Is that true or not?
Under 2104, Your Honor, and I'll get the language now, I believe that they have to file a document that sets forth the terms of the settlement.
So then in this case, even if we affirm, this just isn't going to happen in New York. You're going to take up a piece of paper that's going to be rejected?
No, Your Honor. It's the defendant's responsibility, as I understand it, to file that. And I suspect that the defendants will file it. They're the defendants in the New York action.
Well, I don't want to belabor that point. Go ahead. We'll see what happens to the appeal first. Then everyone can work out the mechanics.
Turning back to the matter of comity, Your Honor, I think that's embedded in the principles of the conflicts of law. And what we're suggesting to the court is that there's another state that we know of where there's a pending action that has a materially greater interest in the action before it.
Let me stop you right there. As I understand it, the New York action was stayed, right?
It was by agreement, yes.
All right. So in terms of comity, frequently when we're dealing with multiple litigations in multiple jurisdictions, there's an issue of which case is moving forward and the other one remains dormant, still alive but stayed until the primary case, if you will, is resolved, and then that wraps up whatever is pending in any other jurisdiction, either directly or indirectly, it has that effect. That seems to be what was going on here as well, in the sense that everything was proceeding in Delaware and the New York action was stayed. Am I right about the overall framework here?
You are correct, Your Honor, about the overall framework.
Okay. That being the case, doesn't that suggest that Delaware is also the place that the resolution of this dispute, if it can be resolved, and it has been, but, you know, that Delaware is the place where the settlement, if there's going to be one, gets resolved, and then whatever is pending elsewhere, in this case New York, gets resolved in a derivative fashion. Why is that not an appropriate, in terms of comity, an appropriate way of approaching this?
Well, you have New York entities, you have New York residents, you have New York litigation that includes parties that are not present here before this court. The parties chose to agree to go forward in Delaware, but all of the discovery was going to be used and could be used further in the New York action. If the parties, if this case ended either by trial or otherwise, then that action would take whatever course it could take. The simple fact is, with respect to The parties had New York and Delaware counsel. It was a very easy thing, I think, for them to ensure when they were drafting a settlement agreement or that they were engaging in these discussions that the laws of the jurisdiction in which those cases were both pending should be adhered to with respect to the formalities required to make to give those effect. They didn't do that. And with respect to those formalities, if they were just mere formalities, it'd be one thing. But the highest court of the state of New York has said that this writing requirement is absolutely necessary.
But there will be a writing requirement satisfied. There would be a written stipulation signed by both parties, filed. What's the issue?
Well, Your Honor, the issue is that that signed writing didn't occur in connection with my client's assent to it.
No, your client will have been ordered to sign it.
Correct.
But that as it may, I mean, there's an issue as to whether your client should properly have been ordered to sign it, but once your client signs it and it is filed, that ends the New York law issue, doesn't it?
It will end the New York law issue subject to a challenge that there shouldn't have been an order requiring him to execute.
Well, what does that mean? Does that mean that your client, if we affirm that your client will go to the New York court and ask the New York court to strike the stipulation?
I think it's a possibility, Your Honor. That, you know, my clients are here challenging this settlement agreement on the grounds that it did not conform with the requirements of New York law. And if this court does not give comity and respect to that, the requirements of New York law, it's very possible that my client could be back in New York challenging this on similar grounds that we're here.
Do we have a final order then to review?
I think you have a final order now in this case, yes.
And you've got about 3 minutes left. Did you want to reserve that?
I would like to reserve that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon again.
My name is William Wachtel, and I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff below and the appellee above. The mechanical question you've asked is really the heart of this matter. There is a stipulation of dismissal that has been agreed to in form. It is the stipulation of dismissal that Vice Chancellor Lamb specifically ordered be signed. And he only made that determination after the parties voluntarily submitted to the jurisdiction of his court to determine whether under Delaware law, a choice that the parties had made militated in favor of the enforcement of a settlement agreement, or whether Delaware law somehow absolved their client of an undertaking that we firmly believed had been undertaken in good faith by his counsel.
Well, I take it from that you're confident when you take this piece of paper to New York, if that happens hypothetically, that it will be accepted and filed.
It will be accepted, it will be filed, and in deference to my colleague, the underlying agreement will not be required. Indeed.
So then, as I understand it, if that happens, then to the extent there's a collateral attack on the New York judgment by your colleague, your response will be that the Delaware Court of Chancery decision, which would then in those circumstances have been affirmed by this court, is entitled to full faith and credit.
Indeed, and in fact, I believe moreover that had they had any real doubt, their opportunity to challenge the jurisdiction of the Chancery Court passed because they had that opportunity, they didn't take it. Now, the fact of the matter is, separate and apart from the mechanics, as a matter of policy, the only policy that arises under 2104, which is a rule under the Rules of Civil Procedure, is that the courts of New York, like all courts, would prefer not to be litigating issues of, well, was there a deal, wasn't there a deal, and what was the deal? Well, the fact of the matter is that's no longer an issue, because in a 30-page decision, Vice Chancellor Lamb specifically said that the 30-page agreements are, in fact, the deal. So even if they deign to go to the New York court and challenge the mechanics, even as a matter of policy, the court's going to say, well, wait a second. You're asking us to revisit whether or not there is an understanding when there's no doubt that there is an understanding. And, in fact, if you look at 2104, it speaks to not only the signing of an agreement by the parties or their attorneys, or it speaks specifically to an order that's been reduced to writing. Well, we have an order. The simple fact is that when this document, which has been approved by both sides in form, is signed, as is required by Vice Chancellor Lamb's order, the New York case will be dismissed. And it not only was stayed from the outset, but the parties acknowledged and agreed that the dispute should go forward in Delaware. Indeed, and I don't know if you wish to take judicial notice, and you'll forgive me, but we checked yesterday, and it's not even on file in New York anymore. Now, that may just be a mistake of the court, but it has been so long that it has had no activity that it isn't even extant. But as I said, that's not in the record before you. Now, the other issue that my colleague has raised is a question under public policy with some claim of tax evasion. Well, obviously, that is a subject matter of great sensitivity, of great concern. So the question is, why was it never raised? Indeed, why is it not in the underlying pleadings, let alone in the record before Vice Chancellor Lamb, who held a full evidentiary hearing, indeed a trial? The answer is because it has no bearing. It has no relevance. But again, their client, who feels that he can charge the lawyers with settling a dispute and then, when all else fails, claim that the lawyers had no authority, and frankly claim in a fashion that caused Vice Chancellor Lamb to conclude that their client testimony, quote, carries little evidentiary weight, is to say, I've got nothing to lose. So these allegations, which are without any support in the record and indeed are baseless, we submit, have no place before this court.
Let's return to the first issue, the New York law issue. My question really goes to how the New York law operates, at least in practice. And by that I mean, if the New York court is asked to pronounce upon the propriety of a settlement of a litigation before that court, does the statute or the New York practice require that the settlement agreement be in written form and presented to the court?
The requirement is that there is a writing confirming the fact that the parties have settled. A stipulation of dismissal or discontinuance in and of itself is
that writing?
Yes, sir.
And that is all that would be required?
That is all that is required.
And is that the practice is that the actual practice?
That is the actual practice. In fairness, I don't think judges are particularly interested in hearing about why a case settled more than the fact that it is settled.
Right. Well, the practice is to submit or to file the stipulation of dismissal, but not the underlying settlement agreement.
Indeed, I submit, and this is a matter of the record, the form of the dismissal in New York has been approved by both parties to this action. So if there was any doubt as to whether or not this document would be self-effectuating, it would have been raised before. Now, I will add one last point, and I'm not going to take all of my time, but I stand ready to answer any questions you want. My client settled the dispute with Mr. Nasser because she wanted closure. She wanted closure in a relationship between a young woman and a gentleman who is now 84 years old, and she thought that she was accommodating him by agreeing to terms which, in her mind, were rather onerous. But the goal was closure, time to move on with life. It gives me great pause to hear for the first time that my esteemed colleagues are suggesting that no matter what this court rules, assuming it's an affirmance, that they're going to continue this challenge, perhaps, in New York courts. And I would simply urge upon the court that in looking at the totality of the record before it, that if it could find its way to render a decision that brings closure, we wholeheartedly endorse it. If for any reason, upon review of the record and review of the arguments that my esteemed colleague has put forth, you have any doubt and it could result in the anomalous circumstance, as I believe Justice Berger pointed out, that somehow, you know, the main action was here in Delaware, the other one was stayed, the main action is resolved, the court rules that it's not only resolved, but it's supposed to be dismissed pursuant to this document, but that somehow that action could come back from the dead, then we would urge the court, under that unusual and unlikely circumstance, to simply let us finally have our day in court, in Chancery Court, and have done with this. There's a time to move on, and we urge that the court, and we thank its indulgence, help us in ensuring that that is indeed what occurs. If you have no other questions, I will stand down.
Very well, thank you.
Your Honor, I'll address one point on that issue and then turn to the illegality argument. The first is with respect to the form of that stipulated dismissal, when that was enforced, that was forced upon us, obviously, by the Court of Chancery below, and our approval to a form of a stipulation doesn't mean that we ever approved that we had to sign it. We simply were instructed to do so. And I refer the court to the text of Rule 2104, specifically the last sentence with respect to what's required under New York law as a procedural matter. Turning to the question of illegality.
Well, before you do, I just want to be as clear as possible on this record. Assuming for the moment that the Court of Chancery's decision gets affirmed, you're basically advising everyone that notwithstanding the trial court's order that you enter into this stipulation of dismissal, you do not intend to take all of the steps that the court anticipates because you will file the stipulation of dismissal, or it will be filed, and then you will attempt to attack it in the New York court. Am I understanding correctly?
It is a possibility that my client will do a collateral attack in New York if this court affirms and that stipulation of dismissal is filed by opposing counsel.
Was the trial court aware of that position?
I'm not aware that it was an issue at the trial court, Your Honor. The trial court hadn't ruled.
Well, on the form of order.
On the form of order.
Well, at that stage, the trial court had ruled.
Well, with respect to the form of order, we were simply ordered to enter into a form of stipulation, which we did, pursuant to the court's instructions.
So hypothetically, the case in Delaware would be entirely concluded. There would be no Delaware action to return to, and you would then proceed with whatever you could accomplish in New York.
It's possible my client will do that, yes. With respect to the question of tax evasion, Your Honor, the records is there's substantial evidence in the record to suggest that Gila Dweck engaged in tax evasion. This comes from substantial.
Can I interrupt for a moment? Was this raised below?
Your Honor, this was not directly raised in an argument below. Enforceability was raised.
Why should we consider it at this point?
You should consider it under Rule 8. And the principle that this court has upheld, that in order to do justice for important questions of public policy, it will hear those issues. There are many states that, even for the first time on appeal, will hear the issue of illegality. And I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.